Hello and welcome. I'm Sam Harris, and it is my true honour and pleasure to host you here on the Growth Mindset podcast. I talk to amazing individuals about how they achieve their dreams and break down the strategies it takes to lead explosive tech businesses to being paid to travel the world. I deep dive into topics such as Bitcoin and fintech, or just how to get stuff done, with the goal of increasing our own collective wisdom and making us all happier, healthier, and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Hello to my lovely listeners. Today we have a super short soundbite episode for you. I'm talking to Felix Chandler about his experiences attending 6 different Vipassana meditation retreats and the insights and benefits that people can learn from doing them. So, this was before I went on my own 10-day Vipassana retreat, and I really had no idea what to expect, and the conversation really helped inspire and prepare me. It's also just useful for anyone with general interest in mindset and happiness and curiosity as to what the hell would happen when you spend 10 days alone with your thoughts. So, as I said, super short, so we're going to jump straight into the interview now.
I've invited you to the podcast today to talk about Vipassana meditation because I've never done it, and I'd first heard about it and heard like 10 days, complete silent retreat, you don't get to talk to anyone, you don't have any devices, you can't even write or anything, and I'm like, I'm full of ideas, I love like having my ideas and sort of doing something with it, and I feel like I have to get some work done every day to feel content, and I feel like I have to do some exercise every day, but if I'm banned from exercise and work and reading, sure, I don't mind not having my phone, but all of these things are suddenly like, okay, I don't know if I can do that.
A really ironic, counterintuitive phenomena I've observed when you go further and further into not writing down your ideas and not thinking about them.
Yeah.
And not thinking about them and acting on them is the more you keep meditating and not thinking about them and putting your energy towards them, the more creative you tend to get, and the more your subconscious comes into play to bring out deeper and deeper ideas and emotions. It's crazy.
That's interesting. Okay, but can you describe what I've now missed out on, like, how does a Vipassana work?
Some, like, etymology and background's probably good, that nowadays more and more people have probably heard of it as it's getting particularly trendy, maybe particularly in the tech world and the mindfulness, new agey subculture, to do meditation retreats, and they're commonly called Vipassana, which is almost a franchised, standardized form in which it's mostly encountered in the West, which is a result of going a monk from Burma who standardized things, and then they open centers around the world which are free to go to. They're usually 10-11 days, can be found anywhere, and yeah, you meditate, means sitting or standing or walking for 8 or so hours a day, and try not to think, or don't try not to think and yet not think. And so it's in a standardized, franchised almost form in the West, and I do like that sort of form, and though I haven't been to one of those ones with those particular Goenka Vipassana rules. So more broadly, you know, coming from a Sanskrit root, and throughout a lot of the Buddhist world they use that word as a general term that applies to a meditation retreat. So throughout a lot of Southeast Asia, from each valley or city, they'll have different practices of meditation retreat. Some might involve more movement, some might be more or less strict or have different eating rules or daily routines. And so when it's used by a lot of Westerners and they say that Vipassana is this standardized, needs to be like this thing, I think it's just technically a bit misguided and not very historically globally informed in the globalist sense of the word, and how it's used in a lot of traditions which have done these things for many hundreds or thousands of years.
Okay, and then what do you get from a Vipassana?
It varies a lot, and just to make things controversial, I'll just mention 2 really divergent perspectives on them. One, you could almost look at it as, well, some of the Vipassanas in Southeast Asia that go extreme and go for a month at the end, they don't give people food for 3 days, you're not meant to sleep for 3 days, and you're meant to just sit, you don't have to go to the toilet anymore, so you just sit and meditate for 3 days non-stop. Now if we look at the physical circumstances, what people are putting themselves through doing that, it's very much akin to torture and brainwashing techniques of the military, etc. If you deprive someone of food and sleep, well, they become more neuroplastic and you can brainwash them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's a religion involved, you know? And so in a lot of them, it's maybe also a way to make... And at the same time, you're told to not think. Don't be critical. Don't think. And in some of them, some aspects I didn't like was you're doing hours and hours of not thinking and sitting there and having no stimulation. And then they'd switch over to a bunch of Buddhist philosophy. some rhetorical, dogmatic bullcrap that is just going to sink in and convert people. And at the end of some of these vipassanas, they're promoting that you become a monk and you're going to, you know, you're going to be saved through the teachings of Buddha and blah, blah, blah. And it has a lot of parallels in the end. As much as I initially put it on a pedestal, there's a lot of guilt and pain and being saved, which has a lot of parallels with Catholicism or a number of other religions. They're going to save you and this is the only way out. And there's promise of rebirth and blah, blah, blah. But as with a lot of religions, I think you can interpret it in different ways, and some areas of Buddhism say focus on making merit and getting a good rebirth, while other interpretations might seem more scientific and practical, and I think a lot of them are what are being more adopted in the West, such as just having a lot of conscious awareness, and through that process of observing all the sensations and feelings through practices of meditations, one might be able to be more in control or less addicted to or attached to all sorts of aspects of one's life. There's one very critical perspective on all these practices. I can definitely frame it in that way. Maybe that is part of it. And at the same time, everyone has very divergent experiences, but for a lot of people, you can experience absolute states of bliss and ecstasy through meditation that are maybe more clear and intense than even ayahuasca or magic mushrooms. You can get to those stages in a more clear way just sitting on the ground, no one drugged you, or, you know, then even, you know, you could look at it from a critical perspective as well and say that just like spirit possession or all sorts of mystical phenomena, maybe they happen more to people when they absolutely believe in it. And I remember back to one of the most amazing highs I had when meditating for days and days, and I just talked with people before, they're all talking about they'd had this experience and blah, blah, blah. And maybe if you absolutely, the power of the mind's amazing, if you really believe, you're going to have the most ecstatic experience ever, and you're sitting there for days with such dedication trying to do it, maybe you will. And that's one perspective. Alternatively, you can just feel definitely that once you slow your mind, don't have stimulation, you can get much more control of your thought patterns. You're not just getting your mind hijacked all the time thinking of miscellaneous, unnecessary, irrelevant things. And I even got to the stage after a few, I've done six now, after a few where you could catch yourself while you're brushing your teeth having some fantasy about next year riding an elephant on the other side of the world, whatever unnecessary thing it is that doesn't really contribute to your happiness or well-being. And I could then get so much awareness of my thought patterns that I could trace back how I ended up thinking in this obscure scenario. And, you know, I thought of an elephant because I saw a picture of an elephant, and I saw a picture of an elephant, you know, because I saw the same color, and I saw the same color because I could go back, say, six steps to, well, initially I saw an ant, and then my mind thought of something else, something else, something else. And the idea in a lot of these practices is you could have so much awareness that you catch yourself the moment you have some stimulation through one of the five senses, and instead of having your mind hijacked, you come back to the present. That's the fundamental idea. But certainly there's a lot of divergence in what people get out of it. Some friends I know that have been there said, yeah, they were thinking the whole time, they didn't get anything out of it, it was pretty boring. A lot of other friends that did a 10-day thing had all sorts of peace of mind, if not supposed ecstatic highs unsurpassed by anything else they've experienced. And then the other relevant question that comes in is, do you just want to get some more awareness of mind and get high, or do you believe in it more dogmatically and seriously? At least 1% might even drive you more in the story of the Buddha, that the whole goal of doing all this is to reach spiritual liberation forever, blah, blah, blah. And I think for a lot of people, even if you have 1% doubt, if you believe in that story 1%, well, that could be a big driver. Do you want eternal bliss? And the almost scary thing that makes you wonder a bit more, you know, I read some books by some monks who claimed these different states of jhana, these different states of ecstasy one could reach through meditation as you got better and better at it. And you're sort of like, that couldn't exist. And, you know, he's articulating that you go through, you know, the best ecstasy you've ever experienced in your life, and then the next stage you get disattached from that, and then it gets a million times better, and like it's like 10 stages of like things just getting so undreamably better than ecstasy connected with the universe. And I would be pretty critical and just read that as any other mystical hoopla, except that I seem to have experienced the first two stages of those 10 stages. And the 10th stage is supposedly nirvana and spiritual liberation. So, well, it makes you wonder, is the third stage going to come if I was to push it and do it more? The other thing I've experienced is that a lot of what can be temporarily obtained or experienced is temporary. You can definitely have a lot of awareness. I've come out of them and I can walk all the way down the street street without any random thoughts popping into my mind. I can just focus on the sensation of walking. And having that control is undoubtedly really powerful, but it's not, it's temporary. It's not permanent. You can reach these amazing states. You can have these amazing highs. And as when I was 18, when I'd finished them, you then go out and have some fried chicken and alcohol and sex and party all night. You've lost it in the morning. Yeah. You know, you watch television for a few days, you've lost it. And so I've also met a monk in Burma that did 30 years hardcore meditation with the pure goal of reaching spiritual enlightenment forever. And I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting to meet him. And he got there and he was very much overweight and unaware and just talking all day and not inspirational or anything. And my first reaction was, oh God, didn't he waste his time? He didn't achieve anything. But then, you know, there's no need to be critical because he may have experienced and gone to amazing places with his mind, but it's not permanent, right? He just came back to the city and worked and watched television.
Yeah, I guess it's a really poignant fact that, like, nothing is permanent. You know, like, I like the quote that even when you say the word future, the first syllable is already in the past. And it's like, everything only lasts as long as it lasts, and it's not worth worrying about so much. And if you do enjoy it, is that any worse than watching TV or something? Or
A lot of the challenge, you know, whether we want to have the goal of becoming spiritually enlightened forever or believing in, you know, more complicated motivations for doing it, there's definitely the basic challenge. A lot of people will go through a lot of frustration and anger, and it'll be really hard for most people. The first couple I did, I left after 7 days.
Yeah.
And a lot of those difficulties come up, and a lot of the benefit will come in for a lot of people just if they didn't have television or computers or phones, if they didn't have any junk food, if they didn't have cigarettes or coffee, and then they had to eat a really clean diet and wake up and go to sleep at a healthy time and have no stresses or responsibilities for 10 days, that is absolutely transformative. Most people just couldn't even believe. And it's really supportive to have a whole bunch of people doing that with you. That's the other really. We're social beings and we'll do it much more easily when there's 200 other people going through pain with a sore back, waking up at 4 a.m. with you. A real challenge when it really goes next level on so many levels is if you have the self-discipline and motivation to go and sit in a tent or your room or wherever for 10 days and meditate all day without talking or looking for stimulation. Once you can get to there, I dare say you're pretty disciplined. And so pragmatically, well, you can just do it now. You don't have to go to a bloody meditation retreat. It's not very complicated. Follow your breath and don't think, but it makes it a lot easier. And when I did one in Burma for 11 days in this amazing retreat in Burma, it was almost all Burmese. And in Burmese culture, still most men go and do a Vipassana or a meditation retreat as a half initiation to being a monk. They go and live as a monk for what they ended up telling me for most men is a year, 6 months to a year and a half living in a monastery, meditating 9 hours a day. A year and a half meditating on your knees 9 hours a day. And so when I was in that environment, I had a very different reference of how hardcore or difficult what I was doing was. And all of a sudden, 10 days seemed really easy. Whereas when I was in the Westerners one in Thailand, it seems really hardcore. Everyone's dropping out and everyone looks like they're in pain and you think it's, oh, I can't go through this. But then the other blokes next to me in Burma had done a year and a half and it's like, oh. And he's like, yeah, this is normal. We enjoy it. Yeah. It's all good.
Like the Roger Bannister 4 minute mile. No one could ever do it. And suddenly like, everyone could do it. And it's like, see you around.
Now that's the end of the interview. Like I said, short and sweet. And I have since been on my own Vipassana meditation, which I'm going to do a full podcast on. And after the course, I wrote down all of my thoughts and ideas and revelations and how they came about and really traced things back, like Felix mentioned, how he could follow his thought processes. And yeah, it was astounding how much that I remembered from the 10 days. Like normally we struggle to remember what we had for breakfast yesterday, but I could go back like a full 10 days and recount the whole day practically. So from this amazing skill, it kind of led to me writing what I'd probably describe as a whole book about Vipassana, quite accidentally. And rather than recording a full 4 hour podcast on that for you straight away this week, I'm going to revise it and get some feedback from other people and make it into a more polished piece of content first. So just like a second and a third draft of a book, really. So after I've done that, I'll work out how to weave it into the podcast, as it was a truly incredible journey that fundamentally changed the way I think and my philosophies on life and just made me a happier, more fulfilled person. So yeah, it'd be really great to distill that down into something that's useful for you guys. I think the most surprising thing is just how funny it is. Like it reads like a stand-up comedy routine, which I can't tell you how happy that makes me and exciting times for you guys in the future. You've listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will. or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to reach out, I'd love to talk to you. On Twitter, I am at SamHarrisTweets, or Instagram, SamJamSnaps. Show notes, along with links to everything that we discuss, are available at growthmindsetpodcast.com, along with information on how to get involved and blog posts on cool things that you should be aware of. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy your next podcast.